KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's important to pass on the idea that the history of art of the 20th century is not something that is finished, that is written once for all.
Biggest ones I worry about are the budget and how can we be fiscally responsible.
Drawing on his Jewish tradition and his culture, talks about the need for people to respect the essential dignity and integrity of all human beings.
Today on Weekday, we're going to talk about the faith's view of love and homosexuality. We'll talk to the Interfaith Amigos. We're also going to talk about the history of art with the president of the Pompidou Center. But we start with a look at East Side voting and the changing politics of the East Side. The East Side of Lake Washington is not dominated by Republican politics alone anymore. New businesses have brought in more politically diverse population of voters. A random sampling at an East Side shopping mall can be shorthand for the changes. Give me a word that describes Obama.
He's intelligent.
Honest.
Give me a word that describes Mitt Romney.
A businessman.
Inexperienced.
They're pretty much the same. Warmonger. Same story.
We went traveling to the East Side to a strip mall that had some nice Japanese food and some other things to talk to voters. Knute Berger has been reporting on East Side politics for decades. His article examining the vote east of Lake Washington is at crosscut.com. He is also, as you well know from tomorrow's show, editor-at-large of Seattle Magazine and writes the Mossback column at crosscut.com, author of Putatopolis and Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. Hi, Skip.
Hey.
Knute. I always have to remember to call you Knute.
Steve. It's good to be here, under any name.
Under any name. All right. 50 Shades of Blue is how you titled this article. Just because you wanted to get in a little bit on that, right?
Absolutely.
Anything to get a little more readers. Is it titillating, though, the voting prospects of the East Side?
Well, I find it really intriguing. I've been kind of diving into it in the last few weeks to write this story. And the thing that really struck me, and I lived on the East Side for a long time and covered politics there. And I'm really looking at sort of what's happened over the last 20 years and especially over the last 10 years. And, you know, I was looking at a map of the 2008 election results, and you sort of see this deep blue Seattle. These are people who voted heavily for Christine Gregoire for governor in 2008. And then you see that, you know, she carried the what we think of as the East Side very significantly. But then the East Side seems to have sort of subdivided into two parts, and that's interesting. There's a Democratic East Side, which is the most populous part of the East Side. And it's not necessarily Seattle Democrats, but it's definitely leaning very heavily Democratic in the elections. And then once you get on the other side of Lake Sammamish, you have a much more traditional sort of Republican suburban and exurban area over there. So I think the politics is definitely changing. It's bluing, but it's also subdividing in some interesting ways.
So to test your thesis, we went to the East Side. Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and I went to the East Side yesterday. And we went to that blue part that you were talking about in Redmond. We traveled to a strip mall, had some nice Japanese, good Chinese bakery, some nice-looking cakes in that Chinese bakery, by the way. Also a birdseed store, and then across the street there was another strip mall with a kebab place and another strip mall with an art store and a computer repair shop. And we were indeed just down the road from that big East Side software and hardware company that has reshaped the East Side. And just sampled some voters as they were coming in and out of restaurants. Here's what we heard.
It's always interesting. It's always interesting to see where things will go. My name is Ben Reed.
My name is Keith White.
What are the issues that are important to you for just broadly for this campaign?
I think the biggest ones I worry about are the budget and how can we be fiscally responsible. I think the second one I worry a lot about is, and that sort of applies to the first one, is what's happening with respect to foreign policy. I think the things that are going to happen over there are going to severely affect us here. And then the third one is sort of wrapped around jobs and education. So how do we get more people working, and how do we get schools working to the level that we need?
Did you watch the debates?
I did.
Did you hear in those debates answers to some of those concerns?
Yeah, I think this is where I use the word leader with Obama, in the sense that I felt like he gave a much more structured process of thinking through it in a realistic fashion, whereas on the Romney side, I worry a lot about foreign policy and his lack of experience, and I worry a lot about jobs and education. Is it really going to meet the needs that we have as a country?
You live over here.
I do, in Issaquah, yeah.
This is supposedly the changing demographic and the changing region. It's purple. It's not blue or red.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way? Do you see a sort of a middle ground, or, I don't know, maybe voters looking for something that they're not getting from the Democrats or the Republicans?
Yeah, I think you're right on the purple scenario. And I worry sometimes that it has to do more with monetary tax type scenarios versus, really the issues that people are trying to address. But it is definitely a purple area. The environment here needs to really sort of step back and take a look at the issues and not just look at it from a red, blue, whatever.
As an Australian who is now a U.S. citizen and I'm able to vote for the first time, I've had a discussion with him and his wife about this so many times. In Australia, it's very, very clear about fiscally Labor and Liberal. By the way, Labor's red and Liberal's blue over there, and it's all very confusing. And that Liberal is actually right of the centre, and it's all very upside down, more than just the country. But what gets so divisive for me are the social issues, where you stand on gay marriage, where you stand on abortion, and those things for me just, it's sad that is what causes divisions in people. And we're, again, as Keith said, not looking at the bigger issues. First of all, again, we all start kind of with your wallet, but then you look to your heart and some of those things. And the fact that they are so binary and divisive, that's what really kind of upsets me a little bit and confuses me as to, you know, where I could or should vote. My name's Drew Sharp.
So Drew Sharp, Keith White, Ben Rudin, three random voters. Chose them as they were walking out a couple of different restaurants as we were wandering around this big strip mall just south of the big Microsoft campus in Redmond. Knute Berger's been thinking about the changing demographics on the east side and the changing look of voters. He's written about it in Crosscut, 50 Shades of Blue, and we went out to talk to some of you voters to get your sense of it. You wrote that the east side has always been kind of a false construct. It's more complex than how Seattleites, what we view it as, all red at one point. That's how Seattleites would view the east side.
Right. It's first of all, I mean, the east side is a construct because what's it east of? It's east of Seattle. So it's kind of an identity. And it's always been kind of regarded by Seattleites as kind of the other.
I like to think of it as just the east side of Lake Washington, and not be so biased. But yes, I get you.
I mean, it's not named after a local landmark of its own or that kind of thing. And it's very complicated. I mean, there are urban centers, there's rural centers, there's farmland, there are communities with very different histories, working class histories, post-war suburban histories. It's a fascinating landscape. The thing that we sort of think of when we think about the East Side is suburban sprawl, and that as being a sort of identifying characteristic, and along with that, a politics that tends to be pretty conservative. And it wasn't really until 1992, I think, was the first time since the Johnson landslide that the East Side voted for a Democrat for president, that, you know, Bill Clinton.
But who were the tradition? We had traditional Republicans that were representing the East Side that were part of that sort of notion of Washington State republicanism.
Yes, and of course that notion of republicanism was different back in the 60s and 70s and whatnot. And you had well into the 90s, you had a lot of Republicans from the East Side who were conservative Republicans, but they weren't anti-government particularly. I mean, they wanted to build roads. They were interested in education. They ranged from somewhat more liberal Republicans like like Alan Blushell and or to kind of stolid stalwarts like Dan McDonald or Jim Horn in the state Senate. And they were very kind of traditional conservatives, not social issues guys particularly. They didn't lead with that. The party in the state, I think the perception is, and I talked to Republicans and Democrats and independents in doing the story. I think there's a perception that, you know, in the 1980s, the state party began to go far to the right, the grassroots sort of the Pat Robertson type, you know, and there was a difference because suburbanites, even suburban Republicans, tended to be in a more moderate zone. Jennifer Dunn, who represented the 8th Congressional District, and it was from Bellevue, it was a conservative Republican and a Reagan Republican, but she was pro-choice. So there were places where the suburbanites tended to be a little more progressive on certain social issues. What you began to see happening in the 90s is Democrats began winning at the state legislative district level. And that's just accelerated since the year 2000, that trend. There's been some back and forth, some ebb and flow. And there's been kind of a fairly steady blue tide.
You know, is this just urbanizing? Is this urbanization? Because you said that, for example, if you go east of Lake Sammamish, the east side, you end up in what we might consider more a modern traditional Republican territory, strong areas for Dino Rossi. I don't know how they voted on for Ellen Craswell, but it's definitely a more developed area now than it was when Ellen Craswell ran with the Highlands. But Issaquah, I don't know about North Bend, maybe you know, but Issaquah, the concentrated town of Issaquah, is that a more purple area than the Highlands?
Yeah, well, it is. Issaquah has tended to be a real swing district over time and in recent years. But in general, the interesting thing, and it was I was talking with Jim Vesely, who is the former editorial page editor of the Seattle Times and East Sider, and has long really looked at East Side politics and is very wise about these things. And he basically said, you know, the divide is along that urban rural growth boundary.
Is that right?
That he said, you know, the thing that really revived or rejuvenated the Democratic Party in this region was the Growth Management Act. It was passed in 1990. By the mid-90s cities, the line that would determine where growth would happen and where the preservation of rural lands would take place was drawn with some modifications around 1994. And what you see now on that map is that Democrat Republican split on the east side, or where dark purple turns to red, is essentially along that line. It's essentially, you know, roughly follows that boundary. And there's a notion that you hear Democratic consultants you know, kick around, which is density equals Democrats. That, and that's of course driven by a couple of things. And there's a chicken and egg thing. You have companies like Microsoft, which have moved in and brought in different types of people, different types of workers, and the workforce over there is younger. It's more diverse. There are a lot of people with you know, who don't have kids. So you have a more sort of urban. They're living in townhouses, high rises. Microsoft moved about 3,600 employees to downtown Bellevue, and then, you know, built tall residential high rises right in the core. Jim Vesely again had a great line where he said the new East Side voter is, you know, it isn't a guy from Medina anymore. It's people who go home in an elevator, and you know that. And so in that sense, when you're talking about Bellevue, Kirkland, and Redmond, there's been a profound change in the workforce. That workforce and the growth management regulations have moved those people into an urbanizing environment, and they're bringing attitudes that urban voters tend to have.
All right, let me play you another piece of tape back into that urbanizing area that you're talking about, and then I want to ask you about, I mean, why we're looking at this is because these are the swing districts that are going to affect, in our state, could affect some local races, definitely affect the legislature, but it's also sort of a microcosm for what people are looking at in Ohio, what people are looking at in Virginia, where these other these same sorts of districts exist. But just to your point about who's listening, who's voting, and who's there, let's go back to that shopping mall that we traveled in near Redmond yesterday.
I already voted. I voted for Gary Johnson, Libertarian. It's the same. It's the media lies that is keeping us asleep, running our country into the toilet. I try to vote for people who will reduce the size of government, because I think that's our problem. Our government is taking over everything.
I really don't follow politics that much, so I'm not sure. I'm feeling like things are turning around more, and it's taken time for them to do what they were supposed to do and promised, and now I see it happening, and it's slowly coming up, the economy, so it'd probably be best, you know, to vote for him because he's on the right track. So that's who I want to vote for, is Obama. I don't keep in touch with my neighbors. I don't talk to my neighbors. It goes based on morals a lot. Mm-hmm. And whoever has better morals and what I think is better. But I usually do split it.
Looking at their campaign ads, they seem to be so consumed with bashing each other. They're not really taking a look at what matters in Washington State.
What are you hearing from your neighbors? How do you feel they're responding to these campaigns?
When I've talked to people about political issues, I think that we're of, at least the people that I hang out with, are of the same mind, that overall budget and budget accountability and employment are kind of the top burning issues, and nobody seems to have a very good idea on how to fix it. My name is Joel Sloss, and I vote out of Renton. Don't let the car I'm driving fool you. I've been unemployed for 7 months. Why am I not mad at Obama? I think that, in part, some of the fiscal policies that have been carried out do fall on his administration. You know, these gigantic bailouts of, you know, what I see as criminally negligent organizations. You know, it's that whole too big to fail thing that I think is just biting the American taxpayer on the butt. And, you know, as the economy is contracted and, you know, I went from being underemployed to being unemployed, you know, I'm not seeing the benefit of these systems, you know, as I push up against, you know, being able to pay my mortgage and facing foreclosure and things like that. You know, it would seem that I'd be more in the Republican camp because, hey, you know, America first, and let's find money for the middle class. I don't consider myself middle class anymore. You know, I've seen the articles that show middle class is really those, you know, 200,000 to 250,000 and up, you know, annual income. And I'm really starting to agree with that the middle class, is, what was the middle class, is now being pushed into the lower and underclasses. But, you know, again, why don't I find Obama personally responsible? I think he inherited such an incredible mess from the Bush administration that it is, and I knew this when I voted for him the first time, it was going to take years to claw out of it. I just didn't think that I'd be having to pay to bail out people who live in, you know, multi-million dollar Fifth Avenue condos and have private jets. You know, that's a bit beyond the pale.
All right, so some more voters from the East Side. Random again, and I tried to pick people from across the, what, you know, what looked to me to be across the age cohort, but we ended up talking to a lot of Democrats. We did ask a lot of people to talk to us who said, yeah, I don't have any time, or uninformed. We got more than our share of, no, I'm too uninformed, which, is, of course, is what you say when you don't want to talk to people who are bugging you in a parking lot. But it was interesting that we ended up with those groups. But we did not go to the Sammamish Plateau. But I was struck by how everybody talked about fiscal responsibility.
Yeah, it's really interesting because when you think about what's the difference between, say, Seattle Democrats and East Side Democrats? One is The East Side Democrats don't, they may vote Democratic most of the time, but they don't necessarily view themselves as Democrats. They view themselves as independents or progressives. They have maybe a different sort of label or non-label. The other thing is this issue of fiscal responsibility, and it's in talking with progressives who work in Redmond, like Andrew Villeneuve of the Progressive, the Northwest Progressive Institute in Redmond. You know, he was saying that the values that come out of the sort of high-tech environment are high energy. They're looking for candidates who are very energetic, work very hard, people who are very pragmatic. There tends to be socially progressive. On the other hand, the fiscal responsibility thing, I think, comes out of an attitude that a lot of Microsofties have, which is government is inefficient, not very smart, and that people can generally do a better job of running their own lives if you have the right tools. And so you have an attitude, towards, say, being in favor of charter schools or education reform issues that Democrats have been relatively slow to embrace. The other thing he points out is, I thought this was really interesting. He said, just look at 520. You know, the East Side really wanted 520 expanded and wanted, better carpool lanes and everything, and basically forced the state to, build the East Side part of 520. And so, we're going to get – it was sort of like, how come we're fighting over building a new bridge? And they sort of point to the fact that, the East Side Bridge is getting built. It's a can-do thing. It's people are in favor of it. And it's – when you get to the city limits of Seattle, that's where you hit – a sort of political, or a literal sort of roadblock. And that is sort of held out as maybe a distinction between the sort of can-do – entrepreneurial, get it done attitude on the East Side versus Seattle, I think, which is perceived as sort of insular and gridlock oriented.
All right, one last quick question. Jim Vesely says the corner of the state now is the corner of 405 and I-90. You have a GOP consultant who says the East Side could seize the center, and the GOP could be the center. Is that going to translate into how we see Reagan Dunn do, or how we see Rob McKenna do?
It explains a lot about how Rob McKenna and Jay Inslee are running. Both of them have represented East Side constituencies. You have Inslee trying to sort of seize the innovation side of the equation. McKenna, unlike most Republicans, has seized education as his side. And they're very much appealing to those voters that we're just talking about who might swing in the election.
All right. You can read Knute Berger's article on the East Side and East Side politics at crosscut.com, 50 Shades of Blue. Because he wants to get you titillated to think about politics. We shall talk to you again tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Skip.
Good morning, it's 9:28. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. I'm Andy Hurst. We have clouds and a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 48 degrees in the University District, working towards a high today of 53. Forecast calls for a chance of rain this morning, then partly sunny skies a little bit later today. Tonight, cloudy, chance of rain overnight, the low in the mid-40s. Clouds and showers expected tomorrow, the high reaching 49.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Multiple Sclerosis Center at Northwest Hospital. The new MS Center offers comprehensive, patient-centered care from infusion to rehab and diagnostic imaging, with all services in one location. More information is available at uwmedicine.org/MS.
Now, speaking of what we're voting on and what people think about, the buzz in the news, of course, is about homosexuality. Referendum 74, and faith, because the faith communities are divided and speaking out on Referendum 74, which would legalize same-sex marriage in this state if you vote yes. So we thought we'd take a look at three of the major Abrahamic faiths and what they say about homosexuality. Give us a little context for that. We talked to the three amigos, Pastor Don McKenzie. He's a former minister, head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. Rabbi Ted Falcon, he's a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. And Imam Jamal Rahman, who's co-founder of the Interfaith Community Church, adjunct faculty at Seattle University. The three interfaith amigos. And Katie Sewell, you went to talk to them.
I did. I invited them into the studio on Tuesday. And to start off, I asked them to give us a basic overview of what each of their religions traditionally teaches about homosexuality. And we started with Pastor Don McKenzie.
Well, traditionally, Christian people have viewed homosexuality as not only unnatural and sinful, but something to be feared. And so much of the teachings that Christian people have had as part of the Christian culture are rooted in that. And there are some scripture readings that are often cited as evidence of the need to be fearful and so forth. One, for example, Jesus is asked about a marriage, and it turns out the question is really about divorce, but that is omitted. And in his culture, in his time, any question about divorce would have to do with a marriage of a man and a woman. So that, but the response that he gives is used to underline the fact that marriage should be between a man and a woman. So it's not. I mean, it makes sense for that time, but it doesn't make sense for us now. So. So Jesus, drawing on his Jewish tradition and his culture, talks about the need for people to respect the essential dignity and integrity of all human beings, but never speaks directly about homosexuality. The Apostle Paul has some comments about it, and there's some other comments. But basically, as I said, the Christian view of homosexuality has been that it is sinful, that it's not natural, and it's to be feared.
All right. Moving down to you, Ted.
Jewish tradition begins with the notion of marriage being between a man and a woman. The purpose of marriage is procreation. There's no doubt about that. The earliest reference to the first man and the first woman, you know, called Adam and Eve. Therefore, people should leave their own families and come together as a unit. There is nothing in the Bible that indicates that there was any recognition of any other kind of marriage. There are some indications in the Bible that there were that homosexuality was a reality, or else there would have been no statement condemning it. A man should not lie with another man like a man would lie with a woman. A statement in the book of Leviticus would not have appeared had that not been, you know, some kind of practice in evidence. However, the prime directive in those days was the growth of the tribe. So any sexual activity that was not aimed at procreation would be seen as abhorrent and would be condemned. Through the ages, feelings and sensitivities and sensibilities started changing, and certainly in my lifetime, I've witnessed a radical shift where religious authorities begin to acknowledge that homosexuality is not an unnatural act, not an unnatural identity, but a minority identity, and it's not choice. It's how we're wired. And we realize even in the animal kingdom that same-sex relationships are in evidence in every species. So it is a minority, but it is natural.
All right. How about you, Jamal?
You know, in Islam, the wisdom and guidance is primarily derived from the Quran, which is the holy book of the Muslims. And in the Quran, there are several verses spread out which talks about Prophet Lut. You say Lot, I think, in your traditions. Lot. And in Islam, a lot, and we say Lut, and we say Prophet Lut. In the area of Sodom and Gomorrah, where in this extraordinarily, I would say, weird story, in all our traditions, the men of that particular towns, they they attack traveling visitors and sodomize them. So based on those handful of verses, there are insights like this is an abomination. You're preferring men to women in your lust. You are transgressing beyond limits. They're Quranic verses. So essentially from that, ideas have been formed about homosexuality as being an abomination. Now, the most telling point is that Muslim homosexuals, as I've talked to them, they say that they agree. It is an abomination. And these verses are referring not to consensual love and tenderness between homosexuals, but to male assault, violence, and rape. But of course, in Islam, marriage is very sacred. Prophet Muhammad said marriage is half of religion. And the Quran says that the wonderful verses about the sanctity, the beauty, the exquisite relationship between man and women. God has created mates from among you, and he has put love in your heart so you may dwell in tranquility with them. But homosexuals say they also believe that. The only thing is they want to live in tenderness, in that beautiful relationship, in the same sex orientation. It's a very difficult subject for Muslims. And if I want to quote Prophet Muhammad, I would say many of us are stuck in knowledge of the tongue and we haven't moved to a knowledge of the heart.
And what does that mean? Can you break that down?
I would say that's having an experiential understanding. So, for example, in my case, I had similar views, meaning I know very little about homosexuality, but I have very strong opinions about it. Until I met Muslim families who've had children who were gay. And of course, my first impulse was to change them and use all my techniques in putting them on the right path. And in the process, I had a knowledge of the heart. In anguish, for example, I remember one particular man saying, he'd call me uncle. Uncle, do you think I want to be gay? My mother wants to commit suicide. My father wants to leave the state. I am like this. And eventually when the parents told me, they believed that this is really something he's been born with, that something shifted in me, I had greater knowledge about it.
We're speaking with the Interfaith Amigos, Pastor Don McKenzie, Rabbi Ted Falcon, and who you just heard, Imam Jamal Rahman, about homosexuality and what is said about it in the Abrahamic faiths. And so we're looking at a very ancient text in all of these religions that goes back, you know, thousands of years. And we have situations in our modern day where people are literally taking those words as this is exactly what happened historically and this is what needs to be followed. What do you think of those sort of literal translations of the Bible and how it's used when it's fighting these fights against legalization of marriage or other homosexual issues?
In Jewish tradition, the texts have always been interpreted. My experience is that the interpretations will reflect the belief of the person who's doing the interpreting. So those people who are already opposed to homosexuality will interpret those verses very literally. Others will look, for example, at a verse that says, "You shall not lie with a man like you lie with a woman," and say, "Well, you can't. The geography is different, you know, so one literally can't take that literally." You know, that one has to look at the context. And certainly the way sodomite mm-hmm. and sodomization, sodomize, is used is much more of a violent act than a loving sexual act. In our day, all the major Jewish organizations, Reform, Reconstructionist, Conservative, Renewal, are supporting homosexuals as their members, as their rabbis, as their cantors, and supporting gay marriage. The only holdouts are the Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox, and in a way that can be expected. They're the same groups that are against ordaining women as rabbis. They're the same groups that are clinging to a much more literal understanding, fearing that all of tradition will be lost unless everything is kept very securely locked in.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least in our country, it's often the Christians that are pointed to as being the most literal and condemning in how they act. What's your response?
Well, I think in the case of these verses that we've been talking about, because fear is such a big part of the culture when it comes to homosexuality, people look for verses to support something that opposes homosexuality, ignoring, as I said before, the kinds of teachings from Jesus that point to the importance of supporting and having compassion for the essential dignity and integrity of every human being, the full humanity of every person. And so those two things then become conflicting things. And the question is, you know, what do you look to from Jesus to interpret homosexuality? And I look to his teachings about, you know, supporting the full humanity of every human being. And today, now that we know that homosexuality is natural, it's not prevalent, but it's natural, I think that it won't be long before the entire world will say, what were they afraid of? Because it doesn't pose a threat. In fact, it really supports the actual diversity of humanity in ways that are interesting and can actually contribute vitality to the culture rather than being a source of fear.
Well, it does bring up the question that since these texts were compiled over a period of time to reflect a culture that was going on in that period of time, how much do these texts actually apply to modern day? What do you think, Jamal?
You know, I actually have a lot of hope. In the Islamic world, progress in this issue, I would say, is slow. The reason I hope is you can also look in the Quran into other verses that could help you. For example, there are several verses in the Quran that says God has deliberately created diversity for one primary reason, so you might get to know the other. There was a very wonderful article in the New York Times by this writer, Robert Wright, a couple of years ago, and the heading was Islamophobia and Homophobia. He said they both have the same root, that one hasn't gotten to know the other on a human and personal level. So I think when Muslims begin to truly, on a human level, get to know a person who is gay, then that understanding will shift. In the same article, there's a wonderful line that says, the meaning of scripture is shaped by social relations. Most of the Muslims I talk to who are very sternly against homosexuality, if I ask them, do you know anyone personally who is gay? Absolutely not. It's something perverse. The other reason I'm very hopeful is Islam lays in the Quran a lot of emphasis on knowledge. The most used word in the Quran is Allah, 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 Allah. But the second most used word is ilm, which means knowledge. And the Quran says a most beautiful prayer is, oh God, increase me in knowledge. So I'm hopeful with increased knowledge, especially knowledge of the heart, views will change.
One of the things we notice over time is that some of the severest critics of homosexuality wind up having homosexual relationships themselves. You know, some of the leaders of groups, if we look into the state of marriage today even, something like 50% of all marriages end in divorce. The focus, putting the focus on gay marriages and thinking that that's going to destroy the institution of marriage is a diversion from looking at, wait a minute, what is happening to relationships between husbands and wives or between husbands and wives in our day that is making the continuity of a primary relationship so fraught with difficulty.
Well, and the Bible also talks about divorce, right?
Yes.
So it could be that pulling out one thing and ignoring the other argument that a lot of people make when they don't believe what, you know, more zealot religious people are saying. But they're picking and choosing.
We always do that. You know, it's one of the favorite things to look at all the verses that we don't do. You know, we don't stone a rebellious child, as the Torah says one should. No. We don't do all kinds of things. In the Christian tradition, all the dietary regulations of Jewish tradition are overturned. Yeah. You know, but you pick and you choose. This is important. That's not important. How do you know that?
I think the sign that we see that says "Don't redefine marriage" is crucial, because the what we're trying to do is not redefine marriage. We're trying to redefine who has access to marriage, and I think it's our hope that doing that would bring more of a strengthening of the foundation of the institution of marriage on a general scale.
Well, and going back to what you said, Jamal, is that what it takes? Does it take people actually knowing somebody who is gay to make that connection, to shift their point of view, or can we get to a spot where we intellectually decide that it's okay?
I would say one of the best ways is to have that experiential understanding by connecting on a human level with somebody who is different. We find this in the area of polarization of politics, of culture, religion. In this case, somebody who is different, somebody who is homosexual. Now, there's another verse in the Quran I want to point to very quickly. Is there's a verse that says, little by little. Progress comes little by little. The Quran's verses came over 23 years, little by little. In the 7th century, there's no verse in the Quran that says that we must abolish slavery. It discourages slavery. It says one of the highest acts of charity is to free a slave from bondage. That's because that was the prevailing culture at that time. And the Quran wisely does not abolish it with one single revelation. Gives us to grow in consciousness individually and collectively. This will happen in the Islamic world little by little.
What do you think, Don? Do you think it's something that people have to personally know somebody else, or can they learn?
I think that when you get to know someone, for example, I've had the experience of finding out that people I've known for a long time are gay or lesbian or bisexual, transgender, whatever. And when you have that kind of revelation, you suddenly, or not suddenly, but you begin to realize that homosexuality is natural, that these are full human beings. There's nothing wrong with them. They pose not only do they pose no threat to society, but giving them access to the institution of marriage, where one can make a commitment to a relationship, will strengthen the institution of marriage. So I think that that's crucial to find out, to get to know people.
Ted, do you have a final word?
I essentially would agree. You know, it's like when we were in the civil rights drama, and some of that conflict actually still exists. It's one thing to intellectually know that we are equal. It's one thing to intellectually know that all people should have access to human services and human rights. But something else happens when we meet and come together and learn about each other and form relationships. Mm. And that's far deeper than an intellectual understanding or an understanding in principle. We think that one of the places we have to really urge people to start in all areas of deep polarization and conflict is to create contexts in which we can meet each other as human beings, and on that ground confront some of the serious issues that we need to look at and we need to solve and we need to heal.
Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. Imam Jamal Rahman is co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Church, and Pastor Don McKenzie is a former minister and head of staff at the University Congregational United Church of Christ. Thanks, all three of you, for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Katie Sewell talking to the three interfaith amigos about how the three major Abrahamic faiths talk about homosexuality. This is Weekday.
Good morning, it's 9:48. I'm Andy Hurst. The fight to eradicate polio has come down to three countries. Two of them, Afghanistan and Pakistan, have both made great progress, despite some pretty big obstacles. Nigeria, on the other hand, hasn't had the same success. In fact, there's been an increase there in polio cases. We'll take an in-depth look at the reasons why this afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from Mirror Stage, presenting the West Coast premiere of Odin's Horse by Rob Kuhn, a modern twist on a classic Nordic myth, at the Ethnic Cultural Theater, October 24th through November 11th. Tickets at mirrorstage.org, theater that gets people talking.
What we watch in the future will be created by the young people of today used to everything on demand.
They don't watch an entire episode of Saturday Night Live, just the bits they want to see. They wait until a series comes out on Netflix and they watch it all at once.
I'm Renee Montaigne. How today's technology will shape tomorrow's entertainment on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That story and much more tomorrow morning from 5 until 9 o'clock. We have cloudy skies and 48 degrees in Seattle's University District, working towards a high today of 53. Chance of rain this morning, then becoming partly sunny a little bit later today. Tonight, cloudy skies with a chance of showers overnight, the low in the mid-40s.
And now, another installment of the Art of Our City. Seattle Art Museum just opened a major new exhibition called Elle. It's a look at modern art by women. Part of this show comes from the Pompidou Center for Contemporary Art in Paris. In 2009, the Pompidou curators decided to remove the art by men and replace it with work by women in their galleries. So Sam's fourth floor special exhibition gallery has more than 130 artworks from the Pompidou. At the same time, Sam curators wanted to revisit the Seattle Museum's galleries. So now to complement the L Pompidou show, there's also L Sam on the museum's third floor. This is the first time that El Pompidou has traveled outside of Paris, so Pompidou President Alain Saban came for the exhibition's opening, and Marcy Silman met up with him and asked them, first of all, just what the Pompidou Center is.
The Centre Pompidou was opened to the public in 1977, and it is home to the French National Museum of Modern Art, with an extremely extensive collection of modern and contemporary art, about 75,000 works that covers all of the visual arts, but also design and architecture. And it's obviously the best collection in Europe, probably one of the best two in the world, with the MoMA in New York. But we also have a lot of performing arts, cinemas, a musical research institute, very large public reading library, all under one roof, a building designed by Renzo Piano and Richard Rogers, which is an icon of 20th century architecture. And now we have moved forward to open a subsidiary in the east of France, in Metz, and we have just launched a mobile Pompidou, which is a mobile exhibition structure that travels around smaller cities in France to bring Picasso, Matisse, and so on to newer audiences.
Take me back, I think it's 2008 or 9 that you took a look at the art that you had in the Pompidou and you decided that it needed a major reorganization.
Yeah, I mean, we have now been thinking of ways to use the collection more. The visitors, they come for the temporary exhibitions and they don't really know what to expect in the permanent collection. Because we rotate the works a lot, because we don't really have a few icons that everybody knows about, like the MoMA has got Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, or the Louvre has got the Mona Lisa. This enables us to play a little more with the collection. I think that's necessary because it's important to pass on the idea that the history of art of the 20th century is not something that is finished, that is written once for all. I mean, it's something that has to be revisited, and there is more to say than the canonic narrative that takes you on from Fauvism to Cubism to etc. So we wanted to play more with the collection, and that also is because we have so little space in every building, in a way. I mean, there is no possibility to extend the building. We are in the heart of historical Paris. Everything is completely full. So the collection, on the other hand, is constantly expanding because it's a contemporary art museum. So every year you have to add a year to the collection. So we have to. The only way to solve that challenge is to rotate the collection more. On the other hand, there was the group of curators, very determined group, mostly female, but not exclusively female, who put forward a proposal for an exhibition on feminism. We suggested the curators to take a broader approach and to think in terms of working with the collection. And then eventually came up with this idea of L, and we thought there was something very strong to do, like ban the men from the museum and do 100% female artist representation of the collection. The decision was actually very easy to make. It seemed so brutally obvious. We thought the timing was right to make this exhibition that would be a big statement, like a manifesto on the role of women in the history of art. And also, I think I'm interested to... We are a very well-attended museum. We have 3.6 million visitors last year. It has increased by 40% in 5 years. So we cater to audiences that are well, much broader than the conventional art world. And I think when you're doing that, it's very important to show that contemporary art is in tune with the big issues that concern society.
What are we seeing in Seattle as compared to what audiences in Paris saw?
It's rather different, obviously, because in Paris it was a presentation of the collection, took a whole floor of the museum, which is about 80,000 square feet. I believe here we have probably like 15,000 square feet, something like that. It's a selection, but it's a selection that has been made to reflect the various chapters of L, which was organized as a thematic and not chronological show, that includes historical works from the modern era, as well as very contemporary works.
This is the first time you've seen the show installed.
Shown outside Paris. I mean, it's first. It hadn't been designed as a traveling exhibition, and the reason why we were convinced to bring it here to Seattle is because we sense such a strong enthusiasm from our colleagues from the SAM, and we really liked how they wanted to not just do a show of masterpieces from the Pompidou, but also revisit the presentation of their own permanent collection, and we've got El SAM, and also involve so many partner cultural organizations around the Seattle area so as to engage the community.
That was Alain Saban. He is the director of the Pompidou Center, speaking with Marcy Silman for The Art of Our City. The Pompidou Center has brought L to Seattle Art Museum, and also, in conjunction with that, SAM curators have created their own version of that same exhibition. That's L SAM. That's on the third floor as well. You can find out more what's happening on the third and fourth floors of SAMs of the Seattle Art Museum. You can start at our website, kuw.org, and look for Seattle Art Museum.
The sound of the day.
Well, speaking of Paris, listener Noel sends us that sound from Paris. He was walking through the metro tunnels at Saint-Michel stop when he heard this group playing. Now, if you remember, Willie Weir talked about how in Asia, where he was traveling, that the South American flute bands had been replaced by guys drumming on various things. And we're going to hear more from those buskers from Willie Weir later next week. But here we are with the traditional buskers of urban centers. If you have heard a more jolly and old world sounding tune from Metro Buskers, send it to us. We want your interesting sound, a sound that makes you think about running through the forest, perhaps, as it has for Brian Buckaloo. Record 30 seconds of it. Send it to us, along with the story behind that sound. Take us to Paris or Myanmar or wherever you can with your smart device, your recording device. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Put Sound of the Day in the subject line. Hey, we got one more hour. And how do we know that? Because we have drones flying all around us. We're going to talk about the Seattle Police Department and its policy on drones. Also, what's in the name? It turns out, you know, you think there's social mobility. Well, you might want to have the right last name. And War of the Worlds in our radio retrospective. Stick around.
It's a minute before 10. Stick around for NPR News coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Walker's Renton Subaru, where Pacific Northwest adventures begin. New and used vehicle inventory and information online at RentonSubaru.com or at Exit 2 off 405 in Renton. Subaru. Think. Feel. Drive.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.